Welcome to True Crime Cat Lawyer. I'm your host, Elise, and sometimes my cat Winston joins me. This podcast contains content of a graphic nature that might not be suitable for all listeners, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, and crimes against animals and children. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, and welcome back to the show. I want to add an extra trigger warning for domestic violence in today's episode. Please listen with caution. On August 22, 2011, at around 8:40 p.m., Katie Benoit and her roommates were baking cookies at their home in Moscow, Idaho. Katie stepped outside to smoke a cigarette, and just a few minutes later, her roommates heard gunshots. Katie had been shot nearly a dozen times with a .45 caliber handgun. A neighbor also heard the shots and saw a man leaving the home in a dark trench coat and hat. Who killed Katie Benoit? Katie was born in Boise, Idaho on April 24, 1989. She was smart, kind, and fun. She played soccer and she was a Girl Scout. When she was 5 years old, she started taking piano and fiddle lessons. Katie attended Boise High School and graduated in 2007. Katie spent a semester at Boise State before she transferred to the University of Idaho. Katie loved hiking and going to football games. She was also a member of the Alpha Gamma Delta sorority. She had a passion for music and dancing, which led her to minor in music. She majored in psychology. Katie graduated from the University of Idaho in December 2010. At the time of her death, Katie was getting ready to start graduate school. In the fall of 2010, before she graduated, Katie took a psychology class with Professor Ernesto Bustamante. By the end of the semester, Katie and Bustamante started dating. The relationship wasn't a good one. Katie's friends and roommates said that the relationship was violent. Katie told them that Bustamante pointed a gun at her on multiple occasions. At one point, Bustamante even put the gun in her mouth. Katie's roommates were concerned about Katie's well-being because Bustamante allegedly had weapons and multiple personalities. In December 2010, Bustamante met with the psychology department chair to discuss complaints that students had made about him. There was an allegation that Bustamante was having sex with students, meaning more than just Katie, and there were complaints that Bustamante was flirtatious and showed favoritism to some students. A different student alleged that Bustamante had been mentally abusive to her and coerced her into having threesomes. This student refused to file a complaint against Bustamante, and during the meeting, Bustamante denied violating any university policies. Katie and Bustamante broke up in May 2011 after Bustamante put a gun to Katie's head for a third time. He also told Katie how he would use the gun to kill her. A month later, Katie filed a complaint with the university about Bustamante's behavior. On June 10, 2011, Katie met with the university to discuss her complaint about Bustamante. They also discussed safety precautions for Katie. Katie called Moscow police after she was referred by campus police. 2 days later, Katie filed a sexual harassment complaint with the university. She said that Bustamante threatened her with a gun on 3 separate occasions: January 2011, Spring Break 2011, and May 2011. The next day, Katie sent an email to the university asking them to wait to serve her complaint on Bustamante. A month later, on July 6th, the university emailed Katie to let her know that the complaint had been served. Bustamante was ordered not to have any contact with Katie. Under university policy, Bustamante had a chance to respond to Katie's complaint. He denied the allegations and said that he and Katie only had a friendship. But the friendship ended because Katie allegedly stole prescriptions from him. Bustamante ended up filing a complaint against Katie, accusing her of making, quote, unfounded complaints and potential defamation of character, end quote. On July 14th, the university asked Moscow police to conduct a threat assessment based on Bustamante's threatening behavior toward Katie. The university then met with Katie again to tell her that they'd be interviewing Bustamante on July 19th. They advised her to stay somewhere other than her apartment. Moscow police tried calling Katie several times and left her voicemails, but Katie didn't return their calls. She told the university that she didn't want the police getting involved. A few days later, the university encouraged Katie to take safety precautions and contact Moscow PD if she needed them. After meeting with the university, Bustamante resigned effective August 19th, just 3 days before Katie's murder. Bustamante was a suspect almost immediately after Katie was found. They tracked down his rental car to the University Inn Best Western. A search warrant was served on the hotel room the day after Katie's murder, and Bustamante's body was found around 8 a.m. that day. He'd shot himself in the head with a revolver. Inside the hotel room, police found clonazepam, Lexapro, lamotrigine, and alprazolam, all prescribed to Bustamante. They also found 5 or 6 guns, including the ones they believed were used in the murder and suicide. There was also ammunition for all of the guns in the hotel room. After resigning from the university, Bustamante got a job in New Jersey, and he was in the process of relocating. He made plans to move on August 24, 2011. Moscow PD didn't know about the threats Bustamante had made to Katie until after her murder. They didn't even know that Bustamante had threatened Katie with a gun on several occasions at the time that they were conducting their threat assessment. According to university officials, they contacted Moscow PD immediately after Katie's initial complaint. They allegedly told law enforcement that a quote-unquote student had been involved in a domestic violence situation, but they didn't provide any details of Katie's allegations, including that she was threatened with a gun on multiple occasions. The university also claimed that because Katie didn't want to discuss her complaint with police, they quote-unquote honored her wishes. After Katie's death, her family filed a tort claim against the University of Idaho for $3 million. In the lawsuit, the family alleged that the university negligently and recklessly hired, retained, and supervised Bustamante, they recklessly failed in its duty to protect Katie from Bustamante, they failed to prevent sexual harassment, they failed to fully inform law enforcement of the danger that Bustamante posed, and they failed to get mental health care treatment for Bustamante, all of which led to a quote-unquote clear and present danger to female students. The lawsuit stated that the university was advised about several red flags of Bustamante. First, he claimed to have 5 different personalities. Second, he carried firearms at all times, which was a violation of campus policy. Third, he talked about shooting and killing students. And fourth, Bustamante was sexually involved with female students for 3 of the 4 years that he worked for the university. The family and the university later settled the case for $375,000 in April 2012. The family planned to donate the money through a memorial fund for Katie. Under the settlement, the university would be required to improve their communication with police and work with Katie's family to create a memorial on campus. The university also had to implement a new yearly student safety forum and make sure that all reasonable allegations of violence and sexual misconduct within the university were investigated so that appropriate action could be taken. And finally, the university and Moscow PD had to improve relations and communications with each other. Every year, the University of Idaho hosts the Katie Benoit Safety Forum in conjunction with Campus Safety Week. Katie Benoit was only 22 years old when she died. She should have had her whole life ahead of her. But sadly, a violent man with a history of mental health issues took that opportunity away from her. Domestic violence is a topic that we cover heavily on this podcast. My goal in sharing these stories is to tell you as much as I possibly can about the victims who were so tragically taken away, but also to educate and inform those who might need help getting out of a similar situation. Because recognizing and asking for help isn't easy. It's not as simple as someone leaving the abusive relationship. 75% of domestic violence-related homicides occur at the end of the relationship, aka when the victim is trying to leave. Leaving an abusive relationship is extremely dangerous, complicated, and complex. We can't judge those who choose to stay. According to the Domestic Violence Hotline, on average, it takes a victim 7 times to leave before staying away for good. Even if there wasn't a very clear danger and threat to someone's life for leaving an abusive relationship, there are still many other obstacles that prevent victims from leaving, such as the victim believes it's in the best interest of their children to have both parents in the home, particularly if the abuser doesn't hurt the kids. Or the victim might have an emotional attachment or love for the abuser, making it harder for them to pull away. They might have a fear of retaliation, a fear of losing custody of their kids. The victim might have an inability to financially provide for themselves and their kids. The victim might have nowhere to go and/or no one to advocate or support them. The victim might be ashamed about the abuse and doesn't want to tell people what's going on. And finally, the victim might be undocumented. If you or someone you know needs help with a domestic violence situation, please contact the Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. You can also text START to 88788 or go online to the hotline's website to chat with a professional. The hotline services are free and they're available 24/7. We'll include a link to the hotline's website in our show notes.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Please subscribe and leave a review if you like the show. You can email case suggestions or comments to truecrimecatlawyer@gmail.com. The links for our social media pages are included in the show notes. And if you want more content, head over to Patreon to join one of our available tiers. Finally, if you're interested in learning more about my co-host, you can check out her Instagram at WinstonTheCatPDX. Thanks again for listening and stay tuned for our next episode.